That's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. What you're talking about doing is a little bit different than what the Nonfiction Brand Podcast typically deals with, because we're talking about personal brands, small business brands, and you've got a whole new entity that you want to talk about branding. But before we get to that, I want to talk about Ken Bush, the personal brand.
Okay.
All right. So, Ken, well, can you give us a 30-second tour of your tour of duty as a professional?
Sure, sure. So I am a frustrated musician amongst good company, I guess, and trained as a journalist and a photographer, began work as a journalist in the B2B magazine world, working on a furniture magazine. From there, a new market was kind of emerging from the European side of the industry, bringing in decorative surfaces and pushing design and creating new mixes of materials and way to sell and use those materials. So I got into that for a few years. We launched a specialized magazine into that market. And from there, through the course of sort of the normal industry, B2B publishing industry at the time, was sold and reconsumed a few times. So I'm essentially a recycled product as it's...
Aren't we all?
Exactly. So I ended up working between the interior design world on educational content for architects and interior designers, and then still very closely with the materials people in the furniture world and trying to connect those two dots. And even though it's only two dots, those connections are still pretty tenuous. So that is still my lifelong mission.
Well, and I think that's key to what you're talking about from my point of view as to what is your nonfiction brand foundation. You are a journalist, you're an educator, you're, you know, an informational channel. So these are the areas you work in. Now, you've described a very specific niche within the business sector, you know, decorative surfaces, materials, things like that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that those things are key or core to your brand. And what I mean by that is you're a writer, you're an artist or a communication artist. You're a, let's call it applied arts artist, whether that's word, whether that's image, whether that's video, whether that's still photography, whatever. You're still out there communicating key concepts to a very specific audience.
Correct. Yeah. So I'm an enthusiast, right? I am not a designer. This is one thing I always have to make very clear. I am not a designer. I can't match socks. I am not a furniture maker. My last woodworking project was a pile of sawdust next to a puddle of blood. Turned out great. But I just love the idea that people have to draw out of their imaginations these environments that we all have to exist in, right? So if your workplace is great, it's beautiful, it's fun, it's well lit, you are much more productive in real life. And when I learned this fact, I was working in a workplace with fluorescent lighting and gray furniture and carpeting. And I was talking to a designer who'd gotten heavily into color theory and said, yeah, no, you could be working so much better in an entirely different design setting. And facts like that just absolutely fascinated me. So I think my enthusiasm, my curiosity comes across when I'm interviewing designers and furniture designers and people who are using these materials and working in that industry. And then I am hyper thorough about trying to capture that experience and share it. So it's part sort of an interest in an area that I have absolutely no talent for, and connecting it to a talent that I have that I don't have any other credible way to express that right now. My novel's not ready. I suck at poetry, but I love communicating about design and trying to convey experiences like that.
I love the way you talked about that, because there are a lot of people who are like, well, does my brand have to be associated with what I have to do to make money? And the answer is, yeah, it does, but it can be through a tenuous connection or maybe an adjacent connection like you just described. Because again, I'm going back to what I would identify as your core nonfiction brand elements, that ability to inform, educate, excite, and interest via the written word, via visuals, via whatever. Well, you can apply that to a interest and, dare I say, passion of yours for architecture and design and modern space utilization. I mean, let's face it, you don't have to be an engineer to do what you're doing, but it sure helps if you understand what engineers need to know to understand what you want to communicate.
Absolutely. Well, so, and what's always fascinating to me is you can walk into a place, you can walk into any place, and it's going to affect how you feel or your energy level or something like that. But you're not going to acknowledge that it's the place creating that within you. So I'm fascinated by people who can take that intentionally and create something good or something more practical or something more durable. And, you know, kind of back to my journalism training, I mean, I've never sort of left the hunt for the truth and transparency and really trying to get to the core of a story. I like to tell people when I'm interviewing them that I have a black belt in asking the stupidest questions possible because I don't want to miss anything. And this happens to me all the time in interviews where I'll take that approach, mostly because it's just who I am. And I don't want to pretend to come off as an expert at the outset of a conversation like that. But it uncovers things that the person I'm interviewing maybe hadn't thought about articulating in that way or hadn't thought about, period. To me, it's really just, I'm kind of a shy person in real life. So it's an excuse to dig into somebody's brain with a shared purpose at the end of it, you know, creating some sort of content or story, or I help people create presentations and I draw a lot of the language for their presentations out of conversations. Yeah, it's kind of I'm capitalizing on my own ignorance in some of these very specific design fields and my passion for making sure I understand what people are trying to say.
Yeah. When you use the word ignorance, I want to flip that word over and say curiosity.
Good.
To be ignorant is a bad thing. To be curious is incredibly good, you know? And what you're talking about to me is the essence of wisdom, which is I don't know, but I want to learn. Mm-hmm. And consequently, you are assuming the role of the audience, your reader, your listener, your viewer, because they don't know what this person knows,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and you want to draw that out of them. So these are the kind of words or the positions I always look at when working with people on developing their nonfiction brand to say, yeah, forget about the architecture side for a moment, unless you are truly a designer, architect, engineer, etc. You're not, you're a communicator. That's one of your main pillars, communication.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the use of the written word, that may be key to who you are as a nonfiction brand as well. But one of the key words I would also apply to you is interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
You have to talk to the guys who engineer the materials and then translate what they know in depth, you know, what I like to call PhD level.
Right.
You need to bring it down to 101 levels or even lower, because the people who might be buying their stuff, they don't need to know all that PhD level.
Right.
But they need to know what they need to know. So consequently, you're a curator, you're an interpreter, you're a conduit between you, your audience, and that expert in whatever the material is, or the space design, the color theory,
right.
all
right.
that stuff, you
right.
know?
Well, and absolutely. I kind of like interpreter. And what happens is if you do this for long enough, you develop a way of kind of cutting to the quick then when you're trying to get somebody who might be a little too far into the weeds as far as their industry lingo or their understanding of, say, and sometimes their understanding of their industry or their market only goes to the next step instead of really picturing the end. So what happens a lot is I find myself, it's a two-way thing, and I organize live events as well where I try and get users of materials, interior architecture materials, and then suppliers and R&D type people from the material side in the same room, and I am interpreting both directions, right? So I can speak just enough design to the material side to keep them interested and help them understand the value of then communicating their side to the design side and the importance of developing a common language. And maybe we'll get into this later, but I'm in an industry where people had 5 or 7 different terms for the same exact product, and
right.
it was really, really holding the industry back. So that's one of the ways, like, I know what you're talking about, and you are talking about the same thing over here on the other side. Let me teach you how to talk about it together.
This episode of the Nonfiction Brand Podcast is brought to you by Nonfiction Brandversity. It's a free Facebook group dedicated to the art and craft of personal branding, and we'd like to invite you. Just search Nonfiction Brandversity on Facebook and ask to join. You're in, guaranteed. I can't wait to see you on campus.
I'm talking with Ken Bush of Material Intelligence, his consulting firm that works with everything from manufacturers of materials, and we'll go into detail about those materials in a second, but also communicating the features, benefits, values of those materials to the people who actually specify those materials in new construction, renovations, etc., for everything from a hotel chain to a high-rise new construction. all around the world. And I know Ken a little bit because I had the pleasure of speaking at the conference he programs, the Decorative Surfaces Conference, which I believe he just got back from San Diego, right?
Just did it in San Diego, yes.
This is a North American-based version of the event that is also held in Europe, typically.
Correct.
And most of the manufacturers of the materials you're talking about are based in Europe. Is that right?
Their motherships, their holding companies, their technology centers, yeah, largely in Europe, some in Asia, but mostly in Europe, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, yeah.
So here's Ken Bush living in Madison, Wisconsin, and he's got an international reputation in a very niche part of the construction, design, architecture, engineering industry. And yet you've been able to grow your reputation over the years and develop it. And now you're looking to take it a step further or maybe even a giant leap further. And I want to save a lot of that discussion for later in this episode and into the one after. But I do want to make sure that everyone understands that when we're talking about materials, what type of materials are you talking about?
Sure. So I have been deep into the furniture materials world since I started with that first B2B magazine in 1999. And basically, we're talking about wood veneers. We're talking about laminates. We're talking about other types of alternate materials for furniture and interior design, focused largely on the commercial market. So where design plays a role, of course, but durability is a big deal, ease of care, et cetera, et cetera. And what's interesting about this industry is so many of these producers are these huge companies for whom the furniture and interior design world is only a small part of their business. And a typical model is there'll be a multi-billion-dollar company that's into packaging, and 7% of their business will be in furniture materials, which is still a significant size business, but doesn't have a lot of the sort of marketing support you'd see for, you know, a great big, the mothership company, their holding company. And then a lot of these different companies have been existing in their own silos for forever and not really figuring out how to coordinate and help the design community better understand how these materials can work together. Their approach for years has been, this is my material, you can use it everywhere. And then The next vendor will come in, this is my material, you can use that everywhere. And then the designer gets confused, either spends too much on an over-engineered material or ends up with something that doesn't perform to the task. And the whole category then of decorative surfaces gets tainted by that experience.
Right.
And they go back to these, their comfort zones, which, you know, solid wood, veneers, stones, things like this. Beautiful materials if you use them the right way, but in many, many commercial projects, not a practical choice, not an environmental choice.
Yeah. And that last phrase you said there, environmental choice, that's a big part into what you want to develop. And
correct.
What we're going to kind of play here with a little bit. This is going to be a little bit different episode than we normally do in the Nonfiction Brand Podcast because Ken has a new entity, and I kind of teased that earlier. What is this entity and what do you want it to do?
So just a little bit of background. In the last 5 years or so, I've gotten involved with presenting to students, design students, and working with design educators. And I was trying to bring, I was kind of working out my pitch to an educator at a national event where all these design teachers get together and share papers and et cetera, et cetera. I was trying to explain the idea of these different materials that work in the interior surfaces world that share design files, right? Everything's digital now. So they share the exact same design visuals. And then it's called value engineering. The up-to-speed interior designer will say, well, I need high performance for this surface, so I'm going to specify a high-pressure laminate, but I want that countertop to match the back feature wall at this hotel reception area. I don't need high-pressure laminate for that. Way too engineered, over-engineered. So there's a lighter weight material. So I'm going through these four or five different options that a designer could choose. I'm speaking to a professor. And he said, okay, you just did a great job of telling me what your industry does, what you guys make. But if I'm going to channel what my students would ask you, why are you doing this? Why do you make these things? And, you know, my first response was try and make a joke out of it. Well, we have thousands of people who need jobs, or factories that need to run.
Right.
He said, no, let me retranslate that. How is your industry, how are these products saving the world? And I had to stop and think about that.
Right.
And then he basically said, you know, and this was 4 or 5 years ago. So now the Generation Z or the Zoomers, I guess they're being called now, have moved into these classes. They were millennials at that time. But any conversation with designers of that age has to start with, how are you saving the world? What is sustainable about your company, your product, your industry? And, you know, it's not just the young designers. They're reflective of the next generation of consumers as well. So, you know, great big fluorescent light bulb, now it's an LED, went off over my head. And I'm like, oh my God, yeah, everything about this industry that I've been working with for the last 25 years actually points towards sustainable use, responsible use of materials. But nobody has ever put that story together for this industry kind of in one spot. Like I say, all these suppliers were in silos of their own and not really, you know, sharing the way they come to market, not sharing the information that specifiers need to make intelligent choices with each other, right? So there's no like, okay, here's how you value engineer a product using these three different materials. So the light bulb goes off, the sustainability story or the how are you saving the world kind of rose to the top as this needs to be our conversation starter. And we actually have probably the best story in the materials world.
I really just want to highlight what you're talking about because, you know, I'm looking at both of us and we're certainly a little bit longer in the tooth than some of those students that you might be talking about. And I remember the day when everything was price, period, price. And to my generation, price is still a driving concern. What I hear you saying is that for this Zoomer or Generation Z, whatever you want to call them, they're now saying our prime consideration, at least the first two things we have to talk about, are sustainability. Because all the things you price-oriented people did, we can't do that anymore unless we want a planet that is uninhabitable. Mm-hmm. So now all of a sudden, the story, which has always been there for some of the materials you're talking about, but never really brought to the forefront, now goes from story 16 to story 1 or 2 in the conversation.
Yeah, well, this is what I'm learning. Yeah, so, you know, I was part of the generation. I'm just after the boomers. I'm probably, the first year of Gen X or whatever that was. Yeah, you know, mindless consumption.
Right.
Totally went there. I bought that for years, right? And, you know, now I'm one of these guys who washes his Ziploc bags and hangs them up to dry and even plastic silverware, just because the thought of that stuff going to a landfill, you know, is heartbreaking. You know, one of the great benefits of what I do is I get to go to, say, the Milan Design Week event. And, you know, there's a great big furniture fair that happens that week, but then different areas of the city pop up in these little design districts and they take over warehouses and retail spaces and outdoor spaces and whatnot. And the whole city is just jumping. But my number one destination, my first destination every time I go, is whatever area they've put all the universities into, because I love student thinking, right?
Right.
And there are just some amazing things to be found there. I bounce through and I just grab little bits, and there was a plastic cup sitting there. And it says, why should something we use for 10 minutes last for 10,000 years?
Right.
And that to me kind of crystallizes that, you know, that approach to the values they're applying to what they buy and why. And, you know, I've been fortunate enough to actually be able to have conversations with some of these people. And, you know, they're all about price is secondary, like you said. It's basically, what is the value of this to the world? How is this saving the world, right? I know I can get this thing for 10 bucks, but for 15 bucks, I can buy from a company that has a stated sustainability policy, or I know that they treat their people well, or I know that this, you know, it's made from a material that is a lot more sustainable. It's always a little bit of a moving target, and maybe we'll get into this conversation in the next section, but a lot has to do with how you introduce those designers, those consumers to these products and the language you use when you just basically tell them the core aspects of that material.
That's where I really want to connect it to the whole nonfiction brand idea. Yeah. Which is, yeah, you've got a bunch of different stories, but not all stories are created equal. And what is your prime story might change over time, even though your core doesn't. Mm-hmm. So let's face it, materials cost is always an issue. You know, if I were to look for three things that people want to know about a material, it would be how much does it cost? Now you're telling me, how does it help us with sustainability? And probably the third one would be durability. Mm-hmm. Right?
Right. Well, and that's a sustainable story right there. If you have to use extremely harsh chemicals to clean a surface in a healthcare setting, especially, that's not sustainable. That's, you know, that's nasty for the environment. If you have a material that has lots of seams where bacteria can get in and grow, right? Then you have to clean it that much harder. And honestly, any cabinetry or millwork made with that kind of design is not going to last long in a healthcare setting. because of the cleaning regimen, right? So all of these sort of different factors weave together to affect really how responsible these specifications are or are not.
Hey, nonfiction branders, did you know I wrote a book? Well, I did, and it's called Rotoma, the ROI of Social Media Top of Mind. I wrote it with my colleague Spencer X. Smith, and it's all about Rotoma, an acronym that means Return on Top of Mind Awareness. Best-selling author and NYU Stern School of Business professor Scott Galloway called it a book that starches the fluff from social media and helps managers allocate capital and find the unicorn among unicorns, ROI. And Chief Content Officer at Marketing Profs, Anne Handley said, "This isn't just a practical way to think about the return on social media. It's also a spot-on, accurate way to reframe your social efforts." Check out all the 5-star reviews on Amazon by searching Rotoma, R-O-T-O-M-A. Pick up your copy today and start building your personal, professional, and small business brand the Rotoma way.
Frequent listeners of the podcast will recognize that I always preach a concept called your key three. What are the key three pillars of who you are, what you do, and how you do it? And in the case of this, what are the key three arguments, stories, or things that you need people to understand about this business is, yeah, price is certainly important. But what you're telling me right now is that sustainability is becoming as or more important, and that durability is always there too. So you've got, those are the key three elements that I would immediately identify for the materials that you're talking about. But right now you're saying the way we talk about it needs to change.
Well, and what you just said, your key three, and thank you for doing that. That was a very nice synopsis. It adds up to value, and value as in values, and something that resonates with the core values of these new generations. And even some of us geezers who would like to see the next generations have a nice place to live as well. It really, yeah, and that is a story, right? Those three things come together to create the why.
Right, and that's key, because as you say, you know, all you have to do is go on TED Talk and look up Simon Sinek to see his why talk, and it's one of the most popular globally. The guy has created an entire industry around that concept of identifying, start with why. What is your why?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because that's what people want to know. That's what informs every aspect of what you do and how you do it. And that also is the thing that is ideally immutable. It does not change. Your why does not change. And if it does change, you've got the wrong why. Because let's face it, if Ken's key three as a human being are to tell the story, let's start first. If Ken's key three are to get the story, to refine the story and communicate the story, that's not going to change. Now, where he does it might change. Maybe it's on social media. Maybe it's video. Maybe it's still photos. That's stuff I'm not interested in. As long as you're aligned with your why, which is to get the story, craft the story, or, you know, refine the story and communicate the story.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to give you that as your key three, whether you like it or not.
I appreciate that. Well, and that's true. I can only do what I know how to do. I happen to really love doing it. The audience changes, the sources change, the location changes, the images might change. But that would be, in my industry, if I have a brand, it is that. It is, I do a good job of accurately conveying what I discover and the people I meet. And, you know, the whole idea is to make them as accessible, make the experience as accessible to as many people as possible. And that's why, you know, back to, you know, writing B2B, I write that's business to business. I try and stay away from industry lingo. I try and write as if I'm writing for a middle schooler, right? Somebody that I'm trying to convince that this is a wonderful industry to work in, kind of a thing, right? So, and it's, you know, you talk about the key three and the story and whatnot. You know, we're in an age of information overload, mega overload. And for people like me with ADD, it's devastating, right?
Right.
So you can get so much information. Some of it might be right, some of it might be wrong, but it's just so much information. That needs to be boiled into a story. If a company really knows what it's doing, if an industry really knows what it's doing, it is taking that information and using it to kind of putting it in an Instapot and creating a nice stew that is the story where everything plays its role, but what you remember is how wonderful it tastes.
I think this is a good place for us to wind down the first half of two episodes with Ken Bush of Material Intelligence. Ken, where can people learn more about you, read some articles, find out more about what you do?
Materialintelligence.com is my website and kind of the core of my content universe. I do my best to keep it updated with articles that are being published. You can Google Ken Bush, K-E-N-N-B-U-S-C-H. We're about to, I think, talk about an article that I've written. If you Google Waste Wood Made Good, it's kind of a manifesto approach to this material story. But materialintelligence.com is where it starts.
Well, there you go. And Ken Bush is really doing some really interesting stuff on the cutting edge of materials, design, architecture, and sustainability. Because, again, as you pointed out, that's becoming the number one story. So you're going to want to definitely check out next week's episode. For now, I'm DP Knutton from the Nonfiction Brand Podcast, and he is
Ken Bush.
And we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.